Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 29, 2014, during a live Teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleform conference call. Today, our Teleform will discuss the extent of the FCC's authority to regulate the Internet. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And finally, this call, unlike many of our calls, is open to the public and open to the press. So please be aware of that. We're happy to welcome to our call today four experts, one of whom is going to serve as our moderator. He is Randolph J. May. He's the president of the Free State Foundation. He's going to give us an opening, and he's going to describe the format of the program for you. And with that, Mr. May, the floor is yours.
Dean, thanks very much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum. As almost everyone on the call knows, I'm sure, after suffering two previous judicial setbacks in its efforts to enforce net neutrality requirements, the FCC is once again proposing to adopt new net neutrality mandates. And it would be a bit of an understatement to say that the Commission's latest rulemaking proposal has drawn a lot of attention, along with lots of debate. Well, that's where we come in. We have a terrific panel of experts with us today. They are all extremely knowledgeable on the subject of net neutrality. Note I didn't say they are extreme, but extremely knowledgeable. Before introducing the panelists and asking them to dive into the discussion, I'm only going to say this by way of a brief setup, but because, I expect that most of you on the call know what we're talking about. So in essence, the Commission wants to put in place rules that prevent Internet service providers from blocking access to any lawful website or from discriminating against any applications or content providers. In the Verizon case decided by the D.C. Circuit in January, the court held that, in effect, the Commission's no-blocking and non-discrimination prohibitions regulated the Internet providers as common carriers, and that this exceeded the Commission's authority because the ISPs are classified as information providers. So now, in the current rulemaking, the FCC is proposing to try to achieve its anti-discrimination objective by invoking what it claims to be its authority under Section 706 of the Communications Act to prohibit ISP practices that are, quote, commercially unreasonable, close quote. And it has asked whether alternatively it should reclassify ISPs as common carriers under Title II of the Act. Okay, well, that's all you need for us to get started, and here's the way we're going to proceed. We're going to have two rounds of initial statements by the panelists, limited at most to 3 or 4 minutes each, which I will enforce. In the first round, I'd like for the panelists to just address the question of whether any new net neutrality rules are needed at all, and if so, why they are needed. And then in the second round of initial statements, the panelists will address the question of the best way for the FCC to proceed, which I expect will focus on the relative merits of the FCC acting under either Section 706 or Title II. After that, they'll have a chance to comment further on anything that their fellow panelists have said and go back and forth a bit, and then we'll open it up to the audience for questions. So as we proceed, you in the audience, be thinking of your questions when we open it up. So I'd like for the panelists to speak in the order that I'm now going to introduce them. First, we'll hear from Daniel Lyons, a professor at Boston College Law School, who also happens to be a member of the Free State Foundation's Board of Academic Advisors. Michael Weinberg will speak next. Michael is Vice President at Public Knowledge. And then following Michael, certainly last but not least, is Maureen Olhausen, who of course is a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. So with that, Daniel, why don't you start us off and take three or four minutes explaining why we do or do not need to adopt net neutrality regulations.
Sure. Thanks, Randy. I'll be frank. I don't think the case for pursuing new net neutrality obligations is particularly strong. And I think it's primarily because I think that existing antitrust law sufficiently protects consumers against the harms that are often put forth by net neutrality proponents. Given the many other things that are on the commission's docket, including the spectrum auction and universal service reforms, I'm really surprised this is the issue that continues to generate so much light and heat in the telecom space. Throughout most of the broadband era, right, broadband providers have really flourished despite lack of a generally enforceable net neutrality obligation, with the exception of the brief period in the rules that were eliminated in early 2014. The industry is literally investing tens of billions of dollars each year, building out and improving broadband networks and making more and more of our lives capable of moving online. So content and application providers are growing not just in quantity, but also in quality, right? More and more things are able to move online. And during this period, we've seen very few instances in which a broadband provider has been accused of violating the principles that we generally think of as underlying net neutrality. So from the 10,000-foot level, the industry seems to be doing okay. At its base, I think the net neutrality debate has been primarily about vertical foreclosure, right? The risk that broadband providers are going to leverage control over that last mile infrastructure, the wires that connect your house to the internet, and use that control in order to affect competition in upstream markets for content and application providers. But economists will tell you that these types of vertical arrangements have ambiguous effects on competition, right? Some of them can be pro-consumer and some of them can be anti-consumer. And in fact, most empirical studies that I've seen suggest that most vertical agreements tend to be helpful and efficient. Right? So we distinguish vertical agreements from horizontal agreements, which are more suspect. And more importantly, right, some that look harmful in the short run can be beneficial in the long run. So take, for example, the well-known case of AT&T and the iPhone. Right, so when the iPhone first came out, AT&T paid and paid dearly to be the exclusive provider of Apple's new product. You could not get an iPhone unless you switched to the AT&T network. And a lot of people at the time thought that might be an anti-competitive practice. In the short run, it certainly gave AT&T an advantage over other wireless providers. But in the long run, right, it meant that Verizon had an incentive to cozy up to Google and invest in the Android platform. And now we have a very robust smartphone market, where before the AT&T iPhone agreement, it was a very sleepy world of feature phones, right? So in the long run, that actually wound up being a vertical combination that benefited consumers. Now, a lot of the arguments for a more robust net neutrality rule tend to flow from the assumption that all content and applications are the same. And I think it's important to note that they aren't. Right, so for example, some are more affected by congestion than others and would benefit from some type of a minimum service guarantee that you could get through paid prioritization. So take, for example, you have, I don't know, four streams coming into a bottleneck at the same time. It's an email, a web page, a Netflix video stream, and a telemedicine application where a New York doctor is assisting remotely with surgery in rural Missouri or something like that. Right, so they all come in and there's not enough space in the network for them all to get through at the same time. You've got to figure out how you're going to prioritize those packets, which gets through first and which doesn't. Under a robust net neutrality rule, it would be something like a first in, first out. There'd be no way to distinguish among the packets on the basis of use. But of course, a network operator, an engineer, would suggest that you would want to prioritize the applications that are going to be most affected by congestion. A couple seconds delay in an email or in a web page is probably going to be imperceptible to the user. But a couple seconds delay in the packets from the Netflix stream causes that, you know, that weird, like, skipping thing, right? And it could be even worse with regard to the telemedicine application. So there are definitely instances where paid prioritization or non-net neutral behavior can be beneficial to consumers. I think the challenge for the FCC is going to be to, or the challenge for regulators generally, right, is to come up with a rule that protects pro-consumer behavior while still safeguarding against anti-consumer behavior, the types of vertical combinations that may be problematic. Because the FCC is right that broadband providers have some incentives to shape traffic for bad reasons, although, again, I think there's very little empirical evidence of this. The rule of reason is a very useful way to distinguish good from bad vertical combinations. And that's why I think antitrust law is probably sufficient to protect us from most of the harms that generate the net neutrality debate, just like it protects us from the same types of harms elsewhere in the economy.
Okay, well, that certainly got us off to a start in the debate. And I know that Michael Weinberg has a different perspective, I think, or I'm quite sure. So, Michael, I'm going to turn it over to you to explain to Daniel and the rest of us why you think he's wrong, if you do.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Daniel, for opening. And I will refrain from just sort of walking through point by point. I'm sure we can have that conversation later, because it will not surprise you that, yeah, I think I probably disagree with some of what you said, although not all of what you said. But I want to kind of, because this is kind of a short opening, I want to frame this a little bit with two important points. I mean, the answer to the question, are rules needed at all, right? Do we need this at all? And I think that the answer is yes, for at least two related reasons. One is that we're talking about a critical communications infrastructure. You know, the internet is important in and of itself on some level, but it's really important as an input, as a platform, however you want to describe it, to fuel all sorts of innovation, growth, economic activity, social activity, all sorts of goods. So the reason we care about this at all isn't because it is some random corner of the economy where there are potentially problems. It's that it's really a central element upon which so much of the rest of our society and economy is built. So that's why we care about this, particularly where if we saw similar dynamics somewhere else, we might not have the same sort of reaction, or at least I might not have the same sort of reaction. The other part is, and Daniel did sort of allude to this, is that ISPs, those companies that connect people to the rest of the internet, they do have the incentive and the ability to interfere with the free flow of information online. The FCC has found that. The D.C. Circuit has found that. I think intuitively that makes a lot of sense from a business standpoint. They're in a position where they can play the role of gatekeeper, and they have the technical ability to actually play that role. And so they have the ability to do it. The question is really, is that a problem? And I agree with Daniel that some of the ways they could abuse that position and interfere with the free flow of information could be seen as antitrust problems. The obvious ones are things where, say, a cable company that's also an internet service provider just does something to their network that advantages their own online video application, or that just disadvantages online video to keep people tied to their cable television subscription, right? Those are kind of obvious, potentially antitrust problems that fit in that classical definition. But one of the problems that we worry about in the net neutrality context is kind of beyond those direct competitive concerns, and more of the knock-on effect of ISPs just sort of putting themselves in a position and erecting an additional barrier to use and innovation online. And so some of those barriers, like I said, could be for competitors, but some of them could just end up being barriers where they enter into the stream and become one more reason why some sort of innovation or some sort of new service or some sort of use is not possible. And when you're talking about those kinds of interference, those kinds of problems, traditional antitrust law is not necessarily optimized or oriented, nor necessarily should it be, for that sort of larger kind of economic problem. And I think that's why when we talk about the importance of net neutrality, it's not to denigrate antitrust law. It's because I think that we have many kinds of law for a reason, and that no one law is necessarily a solution for everything. But we hope that net neutrality as something that is focused on the open internet and how ISPs connect people to the internet can really address a much broader set of concerns and problems. And as one last thing, because I know these are short introductions, I will say that as we think about the history of the internet and the internet regulation up to this point, there will be an argument, you will hear an argument probably throughout this call about whether or not there have been, quote unquote, enough violations to raise concerns, and whether or not the internet has traditionally been regulated as in, with some sort of net neutrality, open internet rules. And I think that, you know, we can count noses on violations and things like that. But it is important to remember that even at times when there were not net neutrality rules on the books, there have been either social norms or regulatory ambiguity that have acted to keep many ISPs in line. And so looking back on the history of the internet, I think it's important to keep that in mind, and I will stop there.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the panelists for so far keeping the statements right in line with the way we had planned. And I'm now going to turn to Commissioner Olhausen, who, first of all, is probably grateful that sitting over at the FTC, her agency is not receiving thousands of emails each day into the FTC's inbox, perhaps. But she has a good perch from which to observe this net neutrality controversy, and I know has long experience and expertise in doing that. So, Commissioner Olhausen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Randy, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this debate today. The first thing that I'll say, though, is my views are my own and not necessarily those of my fellow commissioners. But I have long played a role in the FTC's approach to these issues, net neutrality issues, technology issues, and headed up the FTC's Internet Access Task Force, and we issued a report in June 2007 on broadband connectivity competition policy that addressed some of these issues. And one of the things that I want to talk about today is a little bit of an alternative to the question of, you know, the FCC's approach and whether new rules are appropriate and what's needed in addition to what was upheld by the D.C. Circuit in the Verizon case, and a little bit of an alternative in antitrust and consumer protection, that the FTC's two areas of expertise, and really asking what additional rules are necessary in addition to these, and also to give you a better idea of what the tools that we have are, how we bring them to bear. So one of the, I think, benefits of taking an antitrust approach is I think it's become very clear that the silo model of regulation has really become outdated in this area. We've had, you know, enormous convergence going on. When I was heading up the Internet Access Task Force, wireless broadband was sort of making its way, but it has really exploded since 2007. So we have, you know, new forms of competition. And all this technological change really requires, I think, a very flexible governance approach. And that's why I think the FTC's mandate fits fairly neatly here. And we do have a lot of experience in this area. We do have a common carrier exemption, which I'll get back to later, the import of that. But I do think that our enforcement approach, both on the antitrust side and the consumer protection side, does offer some benefits of transparency and fairness and some other advantages. And it's all done on a very case-specific, case-by-case, fact-specific kind of approach. So I think, you know, one of the benefits of using an antitrust approach is really developing the factual record extensively, because specialization, discrimination, these things can, on balance, make consumers better off, but there may be some more limited cases where it could be anti-competitive and ultimately make consumers worse off. So I think a case-by-case approach is very appropriate there, that rather than sort of an ex-ante attempt to predict sort of across the board whether something will be bad. I also think that we have some fairly well-developed tools, economic analysis, a very good understanding of markets. We also have a very well-developed compliance program. And we are primarily a law enforcement agency, and so we do have experience in designing and enforcing remedies if we do find a problem. And I also think we have a lower chance of capture because we're not an industry-specific regulator. So that is on the antitrust side, but I also don't want to overlook the consumer protection side. And one of the things that really jumped out at me, for example, is Chairman Wheeler's discussion and his statement when they put the new proposal out, a lot of things that he focused on were really consumer protection kinds of issues. So he was concerned about, would a network operator slow the speeds below which the consumer purchased, right? So are they getting a lower quality broadband experience than what the provider promised them? Was there blocking? Is there going to be some expectation of consumers that they'd be able to reach all sites and then the provider says, no, you're not going to be able to? Those are very traditional kinds of consumer protection issues that I think the FTC could really bring some expertise to bear on. I thought it was very interesting and very important that the one part of the open internet order that the DC Circuit did uphold was the transparency requirement. So if companies have to say how they are managing traffic, what a consumer will get and what they won't get, that, and then they don't adhere to that, that to me is a very straightforward, a traditional consumer protection kind of issue that the FTC is well situated to address. So it's really, you know, the rule of law is very important here and holding companies to the promises that they make. And the FTC has really been a very active enforcer in a lot of these spaces involving, you know, large companies, companies that have made certain promises to consumers that they haven't kept. So, for example, we've, you know, brought cases against T-Mobile for cramming just recently, against Apple for in-app purchases, against Google for not adhering to some privacy promises. So I think we do have a fairly clear approach that I think really could address some of the, you know, legitimate issues that people are raising when you've got, you know, the internet service providers and the consumers making sure that they get what was promised to them.
Okay.
So that's it.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. And that's a good segue, really, back over. That's a good perspective from the FTC's point of view, at least from Commissioner Olhausen's. And let's go back over to Daniel and Michael at this point, and let's drill down now and talk specifically about the FCC's authority to proceed, assuming that it is going to, just assume it's going to adopt some regulations, because I suspect there'll be a difference in viewpoint on how it should go about it. So why don't you go first, Daniel, and just, again, if you can just take about three minutes, and then we'll turn to Michael, and then we'll go get some back and forth going as well.
Sure. So I think there's actually two distinct questions there, right? One is whether the FCC has the legal authority to proceed under either Section 706 or Title II reclassification. And then the second, I think, is assuming that's a yes, what would the ideal rule look like?
Right.
I think the Verizon Court sort of blessed the FCC's claim to jurisdiction to use Section 706 to make at least some rules to support an open internet. A lot of us were not convinced that it was going to come out the way that it did, but I think it's fair to say that's settled case law now, and so there's at least some room for the FCC to regulate under Section 706 to reach out to broadband industry practices. And in that light, I think there's actually much to be said for the approach that's suggested in the NPRM. Assuming that the FCC is going to get involved here, the Verizon Court laid out some important barriers or important guideposts as to how the rulemaking ought to proceed. Specifically, it said that the agency's rules need to make room for broadband providers to engage in individualized negotiation with specific content and application providers so that it doesn't look like the broadband providers are being required to treat all content and applications the same, like common carriage. All right, so I think if the FCC winds up proceeding, Section 706 is the right answer because it allows them to develop a very flexible case-by-case approach. And like I had said, I think the central challenge for the FCC is going to be to create a rule that allows them to distinguish between vertical combinations that are pro-consumer and vertical combinations that might be anti-consumer. And I think the word consumer is important there. I think that the focus needs to be on whether or not actions are going to be harmful to consumers. The Supreme Court's made very clear, right, that just because a particular action harms a competitor, it doesn't mean it's necessarily harmful to competition. The commercially reasonable standard that the FCC puts forth, I think, is helpful, but I think the downside is there's so many factors that the FCC has proposed that it could sacrifice predictability, and predictability winds up being pretty important in an industry as dynamic as this one. I think the FCC could probably increase certainty by explaining, sort of consistent with economic theory about vertical agreements, that you know these agreements, these individualized negotiations, could be presumed to be reasonable and put the burden on the complainant to prove that the entity involved has market power and that the practice is itself creating actual consumer harm. So the focus is on the effect that the agreement has on consumers, not the effect that it has on an individual competitor. The other alternative is reclassification via Title II, which I think is legally possible, but I think it's a policy mistake. Just very briefly, the primary concern is to avoid paid prioritization, and for reasons we can get into later, I'm not convinced that the traditional Title II rules as it applied would actually prohibit paid prioritization. And it comes with an important detraction to consumers, as Commissioner Olhausen was noting, that if you reclassify broadband providers as Title II common carriers, the FTC loses its jurisdiction to oversee the area. But I'll leave it to Michael to address that side of the coin.
Okay, and then, Daniel, if Michael's not convinced right now that Section 706 is the way to go and he makes a case for Title II, then I'm sure we'll come back to you and let you respond to him along with Commissioner Olhausen. But Michael, tell us, are you a Section 706 convert now or still in the Title II camp?
I regret to say that I am still in the Title II camp. I've not quite been brought over to the 706 camp.
Okay, well,
yeah,
have at it.
The hour is young. So I think that very briefly, when you think about this, there are a couple questions that you need to ask. First, is it important to have open internet net neutrality rules, which is what we talked about earlier? And if so, what do you mean by an open internet? I think that generally speaking, I can say for sure that people who are coming at this from my direction, I think when you talk to people more generally, when they think about an open internet, they're talking about a single internet without fast lanes or slow lanes where people can access information that they want without interference from their ISPs. And when you talk about 706 as a basis for authority, one of the key things that is a takeaway from the Verizon case is that the FCC cannot do that. They have to allow some sort of differentiation. They cannot obligate ISPs to treat everyone equally. And if you think that is a problem, which I certainly do, and my organization certainly does, then 706 cannot form a basis for strong, real net neutrality rules, because essentially they're stuck between two options, neither of which is satisfying. One is that they implement what I would consider robust net neutrality rules that prevent discrimination, that prevent blocking, that prevent fast lanes and slow lanes online, in which case they will probably be overturned by the D.C. Circuit as being too close to common carrier rules. Alternatively, they implement very weak rules that allow for all sorts of fast lanes, slow lanes, blocking, discrimination. Those rules would probably pass muster or could potentially pass muster with the D.C. Circuit, but they would not actually protect the open Internet. So neither of those two kind of categorical options under 706 are particularly attractive, and I think that's why you've heard so much outcry about them and negative reaction to them. On the other side, the other option is a Title II option, and the Title II option would allow the FCC to first of all, implement just under the rubric of the Verizon decision, because they are classifying internet service providers as common carriers, they are free to implement common carrier-like rules on them, which could ban blocking and discrimination. I think it's important to recognize that Title II would not require the FCC to block discrimination, to block fast lanes and slow lanes, but it would allow them to be able to do so if they felt so compelled. And so that's why when we look at this question, we see Title II as the only option, not because necessarily Title II in and of itself is some sort of magical title within the Communications Act, but because it's the only place that the FCC can ground its authority to create real, robust, open internet rules and the protections that we believe are necessary. So I will stop with that, but I have plenty more to say about this in the future, I'm sure.
Okay, well, hopefully the future will even include a few more minutes here on this call, but I'm going to turn to Commissioner Olhausen to see whether she wants to add anything, perhaps on this Title II 706 dispute, or if not, take a couple minutes to move the discussion forward. But before I do that, I just want to remind the audience again that we're going to give you a chance to ask questions, so keep that in mind, and the panelists, again, are going to have a chance to respond more directly to what's been said. So, Commissioner, if you want to take a few minutes before we do some back and forth, why don't we start with you?
Yes, thank you, Randy. Yes, I have some fairly serious concerns about reclassifying broadband as a Title II common carrier service. And that springs from the fact that the FTC has a common carrier exemption to our statute. So if a common carrier is acting as a common carrier, the FTC doesn't have jurisdiction over them. So what does that mean if broadband gets reclassified as a Title II common carrier service? And here are some of my concerns. As I already mentioned, I thought it was very important the fact that the D.C. Circuit did uphold the transparency requirement. So, for example, if broadband was reclassified as common carrier service, the FTC would not be able to bring a case against an ISP for throttling or blocking in a way that's inconsistent with the promises they had made to consumers. So I think that's concerning to me, because I think we've been a pretty active enforcer of consumer protections, deception, and unfairness. Secondly, even public knowledge in their comment raised the issue of, could an ISP misdirect a subscriber from one website to another website? So I've been at the FTC long enough to remember that the FTC brought a number of cases like this back in the early internet days of the late 90s and the early 2000s for this kinds of misdirection, where we sued companies for doing that or for switching modems and sending people off to different lines and things that they hadn't meant to sign up for. And we would not be able, again, the FTC, if this broadband was classified as common carrier, we would not be able to challenge those kinds of practices. So that raises a lot of concerns for me, because the FTC has been a very active enforcer for consumer rights online. Then one other thing about 706, I do have, the question about discrimination, again, going back to sort of the wearing my antitrust hat, discrimination is not necessarily bad for consumers. And one of my questions is, what's the overlap between saying something is commercially reasonable, or does it actually reduce consumer welfare? And I think that's why antitrust really asks the right question, is whether this practice is actually going to make consumers worse off in the long run, not just a competitor. So I think I'll stop there, but I do have some concerns.
Let's turn those concerns back to Michael maybe first, and specifically with respect to the two things that Commissioner Olhausen addressed. Michael, do you have any concern at all about the FTC's loss of jurisdiction if the ISPs are classified as common carriers? And if you don't, why don't you? And then maybe just also speak briefly to the notion that not all differentiation harms consumers. In fact, to put it another way, a lot of economists believe that the differentiation that takes place in marketplace, particularly ones that are changing quickly and involve fast-paced technologies that in fact consumers benefit from, you know, from being able to have offered new products and services. So respond to those two points, and then we'll get Daniel back into it.
Sure. So I think on the consumer protection question, I think that consumer protection is obviously critically important. I work for a public interest organization that strives to represent consumers in the public interest on these issues. But the question, you know, if the FTC is barred from imposing some sort of punishment for failing to comply with transparency rules or something, that doesn't mean that there's no mechanism to enforce those rules. It just means that the FCC may be able to step in and do that. And I don't believe that the fact that the FTC might be barred from taking an action necessarily means that no action will be taken. And I think that especially when you see something like the transparency rules that have been upheld, the FCC is capable within its sphere of expertise to be able to take steps to protect consumers. And so generally speaking, while I'm a fan of the FTC and I am glad of all the work that it does, I don't know that the fact that it will not be able to play in some very specific areas is a good enough reason to not implement robust open internet rules at the FCC level. And the other, you know, the second point about kind of competition and price discrimination and consumer choice, I think it's absolutely true that at the ISP level there is value generically, you know, as a general principle, to allowing ISPs to offer different services and differentiate. I think one thing that is very important to keep in mind in this market is, of course, the competitive or the lack of competitive aspect of it. And so you don't necessarily have multiple companies with many different offerings disciplining each other and driving them towards a pro-consumer solution. And I think that, again, you know, getting back to where I started at the beginning of this, which is that there's a reason that we have a Federal Communications Commission as an independent commission, I think, because we've recognized as a society that there is something special, that there's something critical about communications infrastructure. And so while some types of discrimination might pass antitrust muster, they still have negative effects on society as a whole that we want to avoid. I mean, I know I certainly disagreed in print, but before about with the ideas of sort of what types of discrimination are optimal and not optimal for ISPs to offer. But we are concerned that there are types of discrimination that don't necessarily run into antitrust problems that create problems. I mean, I will stop here, but the most obvious example that comes to mind is the highest profile open internet action we've seen in the last couple of years, which is Comcast's decision to block BitTorrent. That's not necessarily an anti-competitive concern, but it was a larger concern about the viability of the internet as a platform.
Okay. Well, here's what I want to do now. I want to go back to Professor Lyons to respond, if he would, to the point about the value of differentiation or not to consumer welfare, the relationship, and how proceeding one way or another will impact that, just to wrap up that point at this point. And then I think we'll turn after that to the audience. At least we'll open it up and see whether we have any questions. If we
Randy?
Yeah.
So actually, yeah. After Professor Lyons speak, before you go to the audience, I'd like a chance to respond on the issue about the FTC.
Okay, we're just going to do both of these relatively quickly, and
sure.
So we can see whether we do have audience questions. So why don't you go first, Professor Lyons, and then we'll turn to the commissioner.
Sure, I'll be brief. as I indicated in my opening remarks, right, I think there's differentiation is something that can be pro-consumer. It's been described as sort of fast lanes and slow lanes, but I think a more neutral statement might be sort of paid prioritization. And the best analogy I can think of is, I think Michael's probably seen this in print before, right, is what we think of as the quintessential common carrier, the post office. Right, so when you go to the post office, right, anybody has the ability to send first-class mail, but those who need their packages to get there faster have the opportunity to pay a little bit extra in order to be able to get priority mail or express mail or something like that. That strikes me as an important differentiation and a way in which broadband providers can use their power in order to make content and applications more efficient. At the end of the day, right, broadband is a scarce resource. It's incredibly vast. But there are limits to what the network can handle, and when we run into barriers, we need to figure out how to allocate those scarce resources. Differentiation and allowing tiered service models is a way for the price mechanism in order to sort of sort out and allocate that scarcity the same way that it does elsewhere in society. Now, I take Michael's point that, you know, broadband providers do control circumstances, one of the major bottlenecks in the internet ecosystem, but I'd say there's a number of such bottlenecks, right? So if I'm an app provider, I'm much more worried about the rules that govern Apple's App Store than I am about how my application is going to run once it ultimately gets out to consumers over Verizon's or Comcast network. Those are issues that are squarely within the DOJ and the FTC, and I don't really see many people arguing that the FCC's jurisdiction should extend throughout the entire ecosystem. So I'm not sure, I'm curious as to whether FCC-specific regulation of broadband providers is really all that's at issue here, or whether the FCC's specialization is an argument that could stretch to other areas of the internet ecosystem as well.
Okay, well, you mentioned the FTC, so that was a good prompt to go to Maureen, and then as soon as she's finished, let's have Dean, open it up and see whether we do have questions because we're getting closer to the 3 o'clock hour. Maureen,
great.
You go.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to Michael's point about, in my view, why would you want to lose all the FTC's experience in this area, its expertise? It's over the past more than 20 years, it's brought hundreds of enforcement actions in the internet space, and so you'd be trading the prevention of known consumer harms here by the FTC and well-developed enforcement program against having the ability to have possibly some other agency step in for possibly preventing some other consumer harms that really haven't manifested yet. And you mentioned the Comcast case, and actually, in my opinion, I think that really could have been challenged as a consumer protection issue. If Comcast had not disclosed to its customers, its subscribers, that it was going to be throttling peer-to-peer services, that would be a very straightforward consumer protection issue. So I don't see the FCC as really having the expertise, the sole expertise in the internet sphere. I think the FTC has spent a lot of time, a lot of effort developing that expertise, and I would really hate to see that foreclosed.
Okay. Well, Michael, you take that as a rhetorical question at this point that you may have to answer if we don't have questions.
I'm happy to answer.
I've got some other ones, but I think it would be useful at this point. I'm going to ask Dean to open up the line, and let's see whether we have questions from the audience, please.
Okay. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me, Randy, indulge me while I make a quick announcement about upcoming Teleform conference calls. Tomorrow at 2, we'll be talking about the flash trading phenomenon and how the digital revolution has affected trading. And then on Friday, we'll be discussing Russia and the Ukraine. Those are our Teleforms. We have no fewer than 4 questions at this point, so let's take that first question. I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as possible. We've got about 12 or so minutes left.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Now, let's examine some of the constitutional issues involved here. The Constitution provides no authority to regulate communications. And in fact, because commerce, it does not include information or communications. It only includes tangible commodities, as originally understood. The only place that communications are mentioned in the Constitution, and is under the name press, is to prohibit Congress from regulating them. So, Congress may also define a jurisdiction in the federal courts for private causes of action, and it would certainly be possible for organizations like the FTC or the FCC to investigate, to report, to set up guidelines, to serve as expert witnesses, perhaps to file amicus briefs. But the power to create jurisdictions cannot include the power to confer on Congress powers it doesn't have.
John, as moderator, I think we get the gist of the question, and I want to make sure we get to some others. So I think if the panelists want to briefly respond to the question as to whether the FCC has constitutional authority to act here, why don't they do so? And otherwise, I think we've gotten your point.
This is Daniel. Can I tackle that really quickly?
Yeah.
I think regardless of the original understanding of the Commerce Clause, we're sort of bound now by the broad understanding of it the courts have entered into for about 60 or 70 years, and you'd be upsetting the apple cart quite a bit to go back and undo most of the administrative state. If nothing else, the network and wiring and physical components that go into the ground are commerce. And they move from state to state, and to the extent that the necessary and proper clause allows you to regulate things that are incidental to commerce, I think it falls under there. More importantly, I think you want federal regulation here, at least to some extent, because the power of these are interstate communications networks whose effects cross state lines. And so if the federal government can't preempt state regulatory authority, then what you would have is the balkanization of our communication system by 50 different state public utilities commissions, each of which have unlimited police power, and at least their police power is not limited by the Constitution except by the Supremacy Clause and the Commerce Clause.
Okay, let's take another question, Dean. Hello?
Hi, this is Chris Garvey. I'm a perennial libertarian candidate, and as a libertarian, I tend to like to give companies as much freedom as they can, but these are not ordinary companies. These are generally monopolies or duopolies. The last mile between the central office and the consumer is regulated by local franchise rules and access and right-of-ways, which are basically sold on the basis of bribes to communities, who knows how many bribes to the local politicians, so that on Long Island we had only one cable carrier, which became the internet carrier, and the only reason they got any competition is because we had a telephone company that was also able to get into the business. But that last mile creates monopolies in these organizations, and that's got to be addressed. I would like to see more competition as the better solution, but at the moment, the coziness between the incumbent politicians and the cable companies that have the access to the last mile is not particularly trustworthy. And we have seen discrimination here on Long Island by the cable company against, say, the Libertarian Party.
Let's see whether anyone wants to respond to that, maybe Commissioner Olhausen or Daniel, perhaps, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, so that's certainly the question of how many competitors were in the marketplace was one we consider very carefully in the FTC's 2007 report on this issue. And one of the things that we have seen, I think, is a growth in competition from wireless, right? Wireless broadband does introduce a new competitor into the marketplace. But I think one of the most important things to think about in designing net neutrality rules, or whether net neutrality is required, is will such rules foster more competition in ISPs and broadband providers, or will it freeze into place the structure that we have now. And I think that's a very important question to ask about what are the incentives to invest for new companies, new ISPs to get in, if they're going to have restrictions on how they can use their assets.
Also, Comcast and Time Warner are trying to merge to reduce competition even further.
I think when you're,
Professor Alliance, do you want to add anything at this point?
Yeah, I think when you're talking about limits on competition in the broadband market, it's important to distinguish between economic forces that limit competition, right? There's only so many customers per square mile. You need a minimum number of customers per mile of line in order to make it profitable. But also there's legal limits on competition. And I think the point you make, Chris, is a good one, that historically local franchise agreements have been a barrier to entry, at least in the traditional cable market.
And the telephone market.
Those limits tended to be problematic. One of the things I really liked was in 2006 or 2007, the FCC stepped in and preempted a lot of traditional rules that were prohibiting the development of competition in the cable space. And it was after those that really Verizon and AT&T and some of the others were able to provide real facilities-based competition in cable. So I think you're right that legal authority, those types of legal local franchise agreements can be problematic. But I also think the FCC is attuned to that issue, and they've done actually a decent job of late of keeping an eye on it.
Chris, you're tempting me to get out of my moderator's role here to say that the most important competition that we have to focus on really is the intermodal facilities competition between the different technology platforms, for example, cable, telephone, wireless, and now Google is going into places. So when Time Warner merges with Comcast, for example, they don't compete with each other to provide broadband service in local communities. So it's worthwhile at least trying to think about it in terms of whether there's competition among the different platforms, and not to think of the old traditional legacy models like telephone companies and cable companies and wireless companies, because they're all providing broadband services. But what I want to do now is ask Dean to find out whether there are other questioners on the line, and we'll take another question.
Randy, we do have two more questions pending. If you are in the audience and have a question, you need to indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Hello?
Hi, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. This is Lynn Stanton at TR Daily. I guess this is mainly a question for Michael, although I certainly would welcome response from others as well. The other side in this debate argues that Title II reclassification would not, in fact, prevent discrimination. And of course, under Title II regulation of telecom companies, they had contract tariffs that provided different rates and different kinds of services with volume discounts and capacity discounts. And I was just wondering if you could address why it is that you think the Title II reclassification will address the kinds of concerns that you have about Internet fast lanes.
Sure, and thank you for the question. And I think there's a much longer answer in our comments, but I'll give you the short answer for the benefit of everyone involved. I think that, as I alluded to earlier, our position is not that if the FCC reclassifies under Title II, all of a sudden automatic all blocking and discrimination is prevented or outlawed. It is certainly possible under a Title II regime that there are types of discrimination that are allowed or sanctioned, or you know, however you want to describe it. Our position instead is that if you are in a Title II regime, it then allows you, it gives you the opportunity to impose rules that prevent blocking and discrimination. And so Title II is a necessary component of being able to take that step, but it is not in and of itself an end.
Thank you. And does anyone else want to address?
I think that's a great way to frame that, Michael, because I think you're exactly right. I think Title II gives you the option but not the mandate to eliminate paid prioritization. The one difficulty I think the FCC runs into is that they would have to explain why it is that the same language applies differently to traditional telephone companies than it does to broadband providers. In other words, we would allow the equivalent of paid prioritization to telephone companies back in the monopoly era, but now we're not with regard to broadband providers in a what I would say is a more competitive space. I think that's a difficult needle for them to thread, not one that's impossible, but another legal hurdle for them.
Thank you.
Okay, Dean, let's try and take another question.
Yeah, we've got just the one question pending, so here's the final question.
Hi, this is Paula Vigna-Gonti, a reporter with Global Competition Review. My question is about the effect that having the FCC versus FTC working on this would have with regard to private litigation. I'm not aware of there being sort of as much in the way of kind of follow-on private actions after FCC enforcement as you tend to have from the antitrust agencies.
Well, one of the things about Section 5 of the FTC Act is it does not give a private right of action to companies. So that does, I'm not sure that's any different than the FCC. Certainly there have been, class actions that follow some FTC consumer protection enforcement, and sometimes we work with states because they have similar little FTC statutes. Particularly in the consumer protection area.
Anyone want to add to that? I think we just had the authority speak on that question. Dean, are you able to determine whether anyone else has gotten in the queue to ask a question?
No, our lines are wide open at this point, Randy.
Okay. Well, at least according to my watch, it's 2:57, so I think we can wind up, and maybe what I'll do, this sounds awfully hard, but I'm going to ask the panelists in just a moment whether they want to, I want to thank them first for their participation and ask them whether they want to just try and sum up anything in one sentence, but I'm going to, I know our first caller was John asking that question about the Constitution, and I'm just going to mention for the benefit of all of our audience members, there's a new book by Professor Philip Hamburger. I think the title is Administrative Law Unconstitutional, and it deals with questions just in the vein that he was asking that question. So with that, Professor Lyons, do you want to sum up in one sentence, and then we'll just go right down the line in order to wrap it up?
Sure.
One or two sentences.
Yeah, I think the big challenge for the FCC is trying to fit an internet architecture into a pre-internet statute. No solution, I think, is going to be optimal for anyone. I think, I don't want to speak for the other panelists, but I think the optimal solution here is for Congress to decide what jurisdiction, if any, the FCC should have going forward.
Okay, and that's fair, by the way. So, Michael, you take three or four, five sentences as well to sum up.
Yeah, I would say that, I value the open internet, and I believe that the FCC is best positioned to protect it with rules. I think it does have the authority to create real, meaningful, and robust open internet rules. While there are upsides to congressional action in the long term, I think certainly in the short and medium term, the FCC has all the authority it needs to protect an open internet.
Okay, Commissioner.
Well, I would pose the question of why and do we have evidence to believe that additional rules are really necessary to make consumers better off, those rules in addition to antitrust and consumer protection, and then particularly to take an approach that risks divesting the Federal Trade Commission of its well-developed, actively exercised consumer protection authority that it has used to protect consumers in the internet space for over 20 years.
Okay, well, Dean, I'm going to turn it back over to you, but thanks again to the panelists. I know we could all go on for another hour, but I thought this was a very informative, interesting, and lively discussion. Thanks to all.
Thank you, Randy.
Thank
let
you.
Me, let me,
yeah,
let me add
you.
my Let me add my thanks in particular to Randy May for organizing this and for serving as our moderator today. He is the president of the Free State Foundation. But I also want to thank on behalf of the Federalist Society, Michael Weinberg, Professor Lyons, and Commissioner Olhausen for joining us as well. Our sincere thanks from here at the Federalist Society to our audience. Randy May mentioned the Philip Hamburger book is Administrative Law Unlawful. It was a subject of a previous Teleform conference call, and the audio of that is available at the Federalist Society's website. And a reminder about our call tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be discussing flash trading. But until that next Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.